call is from?
Eric.
An inmate at the Bergen County Jail. This call will be monitored and recorded.
Hey there, Eric.
Hi, Matt.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you okay.
Eric Jurek is 38 years old and from Slovakia. He's been in the United States for almost 2 years, but for more than half of that time, he's been in immigration detention.
What were the circumstances behind you getting picked up by ICE?
They came to my apartment like a couple minutes before 6 in the morning. I was getting ready for work. And, you know, they tricked me that, you know, they just want to talk to me because there was an accident on the construction and stuff. So I said, okay, why not? I didn't, you know, I was just talking on the phone. I was living on third floor, so I didn't see who is down there. So I opened the door, and after that, I had 7 guys in my apartment, and they were just saying that they checked my identity, and after that, they were saying that I overstayed, and they picked me up, and that's it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, in for Amy Walter, who's away this week. Today, a look at ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the one federal agency tasked with finding and removing immigrants in violation of immigration laws. Now, President Trump is putting the agency's size and strength to the test. Under this administration, ICE has ramped up enforcement. This year, arrests of undocumented immigrants are up 17%, and removals from the country are up about 9%. And ICE agents aren't just targeting immigrants who've committed violent crimes. Thousands of immigrants currently languishing in immigration detention have committed no crime other than being here without proper documentation. In my regular job, I'm a reporter for WNYC, and I've been covering the impact of the ramped-up immigration enforcement. I've spent some time visiting the detention centers where immigrants from New York are held. Most end up in 2 county jails in New Jersey that have lucrative detention contracts with ICE. So many immigrants are getting locked up that the majority of the population of these 2 jails are now ICE detainees, not locally charged criminals. I've been especially interested in the Bergen County Jail, where detainees complain of poor living standards. The sheriff who runs the jail recently resigned after we aired a secret recording of him making a series of racist comments.
He talked about the whole thing, the marijuana, sanctuary state.
He did talk about the sanctuary state?
Yeah.
Like in those terms?
Yeah. Better criminal justice reform. In other words, let the blacks come in, do whatever the fuck they want, smoke the marijuana, do this, do that, and don't worry about it. You know, we'll tie the hands of cops.
And there's one other thing about the Bergen County Jail that caught my attention. Under that sheriff, immigrants, even those charged with no other crime other than lacking documents, are forbidden from touching, hugging, and kissing their loved ones who visit. That's unusual, and it's how I first started talking to Eric Jurek. When his wife visits, he must look at her through a glass partition. He's been detained at Bergen County Jail for nearly a year now.
I overstayed my visa, so I understand that's why I'm here. I entered the country in December 29, 2016, on the Waiver Viva program, which allows me to stay in the country for 90 days. And I overstayed my visa 8 months, and December 13, 2017, the ICE picked me up from my house, and I'm here. And I'm already reaching the 1 year.
So let me get this straight. You've spent most of your time in the United States in jail.
I know the American more from the jail than from outside.
The government said that you had, your lawyer had requested a couple of delays. Is that accurate? They requested?
No. I had only the master hearing in the January 30th, 2018. Then on March 8th, I went for the court to Warwick Street, and my lawyer, she submitted the asylum, but the judge didn't show up, so we didn't do anything. And because on that day it was the snowstorm. So they gave me another court in 4 months later in July 9. And July 9, they called me like 4 o'clock. And when I went there, the judge was saying that she doesn't have the time for me because it was too late. So she rescheduled me again for September 10. And in September 10, when I was supposed to go for the court, there was a Jewish holiday, the new year for them. They said, the paperwork, it showed up that they had a problem with the internet. So they couldn't make the video call. So they rescheduled me again for October 11, and on October 11, there was another time happened that there was no internet connection.
Because
so they rescheduled me again for January 4th.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
ICE no longer allows immigrant detainees here to see a judge in person. They conduct all hearings from this jail via one video conferencing system, though two more video booths will soon be added, according to the sheriff's office. Jurek's next hearing is scheduled for January. He's seeking asylum based on discrimination he says he faced in Slovakia due to the color of his skin. And he's hoping to get permanent residency through his wife, who's a U.S. citizen. Jurek has no other criminal record, but a source in federal government told me that he does have an arrest warrant for a financial crime back in Slovakia. That may have gotten him on ICE's radar, but it's not part of the case against him. And Jurek attributed it all to a business dispute with his ex-wife and his inability to fight the charges because he's been locked up for so long. After the time expired for our first call from the jail, we were able to get Jurek back on the phone. I asked him to describe his unit and his cell to me.
I read in the newspaper that the government pay for the jail nice money, like $150 per day. But I don't see that money over here, nothing. Our unit is like 64 people, and we're sharing like 1,000 square feet, you know, and these old people are here. There is like not enough chairs for everybody, you know, so most of the time during the day it looks like on train station, you know, like people waiting for the train. You know, nobody knows what to do because there is a small space for everybody. So we just walk like in the cage.
So you say you pass the time by walking back and forth from one end of the unit to the other?
Yeah. That's the only option. Like, you know, our unit, it's like the shape of the square. So that's the only thing you can like exercise or something. We have a yard like one hour a day. And the yard is like even smaller than our unit, so it's hard to play or something or exercise or something. And especially in the winter, we have only 11 jackets available for 64 people. So you have to be kind of chosen if you wanna go outside and, you know, exercise, because nowadays it's like a really cold, and you know, not everybody can take that cold.
I understand you've also had some medical issues with your teeth. Can you explain what the medical conditions are like in there?
Yeah, so my problem started in February when I lost my feeling in my tooth. And since that time, I visited the dentist like maybe 5 times. And every time he was saying that I had to fix it outside because I have a root canal. But he just said that without like taking the X-ray or something, you know. In that, our dentist over here, he doesn't have like electric tools. He has only the basic tools, like that little mirror, and you know, and mostly he's just using the hands, you know. So, and the only option is when you have a toothache, it's like he can take it out, you know. But in my case, he was saying I have a big root canal, and since that tooth was infected and. My pain started like 2 weeks ago, like really big one. So 2 weeks ago, more than 2 weeks ago, I found out that I have like a really big headache, and also my head, it appeared the bump between my right ear and my right eye. The bump is size like a teaspoon, so I got scared. And also I started kind of losing the sight on the right eye, so you know, I reported right away. So they took me to the emergency room, to emergency hospital outside, but the emergency doctor was saying that it might be from the tooth, it might be from the eye, it might be from the headache, or I mean from the brain. So he recommended to visit a specialist, but since that time, my pain is over 2 weeks, and they just feed me with the painkillers, and they never called me for the specialist. I wrote a sick call every day, but it doesn't help.
Are you in pain right now as we speak?
Yeah. Last day, they didn't give me the painkiller, so I had bought it myself from the commissary, the ibuprofen, but it's not strong enough.
You're also concerned that there are some basics that are in short supply at the jail, things that many of us on the outside wouldn't necessarily even think about being an issue or a problem, like clean blankets and razors. Can you tell me about those?
Yeah. With the blankets, since I've been here almost 1 year, they changed the blankets. They washed them only twice, which is like really poor, you know, and especially in the condition like we're living here. I don't know how they do the laundry, but the clothes are coming, you know, colored. And last time I remember when the officer was saying that they put the clothes with the dirty mops, they wash them with the clothes, so it's just filthy, you know. And from that point, you know, many people, they have rashes, you know, scratching and itching, and it's just not good. I'm just like I said at the beginning, I'm just wondering where all this money goes. You know, I've been here almost 1 year, but there is no penny spent in our unit. Even with the simple basic things, like you have to ask and beg for the chair, for the toilet paper, for the razors. The razors are not available. They will just say, you know, we have 10 left, or, you know, something like that. It's just like that.
Do you think that you'll ever get out of there? Do you wonder if you're ever going to be able to get out of there, or are you hopeful?
Yeah, of course. I have a big faith in God, and I have a still dream that I can get justice here in America. And I understand that I made a mistake. I overstayed my visa, but also I paid for my mistake. I have only God and my wife outside, nothing else. I lost everything. I lost money. I lost my apartment. I lost my car. But I don't care. I'm still alive. I believe that one day I will walk on the street in New York, because I'm no criminal, you know?
Thank you so much, Eric. Take care.
All right.
Alrighty.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As of next week, Eric Jurek will have spent 1 year at the Bergen County Jail without having the chance to argue the merits of his case before a judge. The jail bills ICE and federal taxpayers $110 for each day he's there. The sheriff in Bergen County is new. He was recently elected to replace the sheriff who resigned after making racist comments. Through a spokesman, the new sheriff denied Eric's allegations about the conditions at the jail. He says there's enough seating to accommodate detainees and plenty of coats, toiletries, and recreational activities to go around. He is, however, reviewing the policy that forbids detainees from hugging their spouses and kids who visit. All this hour, we're exploring how immigration laws are enforced in this country. Aviva Chomsky is a professor of history and a coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University. She walks us through the history of American immigration and how, from the very beginning, it was racialized.
This is a settler colonial society. This means that the United States is a country founded of, by, and for white settler colonizers. And the original immigrants to the United States were English people who were coming to settle, steal, take land from a native population.
So because this country was founded by the colonizers, that ended up affecting how immigration policy and the views toward immigrants going forward for the next several centuries?
Absolutely. And one of their goals, in fact, and you see it right in the Declaration of Independence, was to bring in more white immigrants. One of their objections to the British Crown was that the British Crown was limiting immigration and limiting the taking of native land. And these are part of the same bullet point in the Declaration of Independence. And they're formalized in the First Naturalization Act of 1790, which makes it very, very easy for white immigrants to naturalize. Only white people can be citizens, of course, of the new country.
How easy was it to naturalize? If you were white, can you show up and you're a citizen?
There are no restrictions on entry. So if you're white, you just show up and you're here. And the restrictions on citizenship are all racial restrictions. That is, black people cannot be citizens. Native Americans cannot be citizens. White people, all you have to do is arrive here, and in 2 years, you become a citizen, period. It's really not until after the Civil War that citizenship is opened up at all. And it's opened up only in very specific ways, acknowledging the wrongs of the enslavement of Africans and the forced transport of Africans and their exclusion even of free people of African descent from the nation. The other way that citizenship is opened up after the Civil War is through citizenship by birth. That is, any person born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a citizen of the United States. And subject to the jurisdiction thereof, that qualification refers to Native Americans. That is, they are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Therefore, they are explicitly excluded from citizenship by birth. The naturalization law, though, conflicts with citizenship by birth, because naturalization is only opened to white persons and persons of African nativity and African descent. But again, it's 1870. There are many immigrants coming to the United States who are neither free white persons nor persons of African nativity and African descent. That is, in particular, the Chinese and the Mexicans.
Is that the vast majority of non-white immigrants who are coming in at this point in the late 19th century?
Yes, it is. So there's this contradiction between citizenship by birth and exclusive naturalization. Because what happens if a person who is under the naturalization law defined as racially ineligible to citizenship, and that's the language that Congress uses, what happens if that person, mostly Chinese we're talking about at the time, comes to the United States, has a baby, and that baby is racially ineligible to citizenship, but obtains citizenship by birth? It's a logical contradiction. Congress has to find a way out of this logical impossibility. And this is when they start restricting immigration. In order to prevent Chinese people from obtaining citizenship by birth, they begin Chinese exclusion, starting actually in 1873 when they exclude Chinese women, and then expanding that to all Chinese, and by 1917, expanding that to what they call the Asiatic Barred Zone. Approximately two-thirds of the planet's population is legally classified as Asian, therefore racially ineligible to citizenship, therefore prohibited from immigrating to the United States.
Wow. And during this period, how are we treating immigrants to our south who are coming up from Mexico and Central America?
This is the third strand of U.S. immigration policy. So for Europeans, it's the open door. For Asians, it's the closed door. For Mexicans, it's a revolving door. That is, Mexican labor is so crucial, so necessary to the economy of the West and the Southwest, especially after the Chinese are excluded, the need for Mexican labor is even greater, that under pressure from employers, Congress decides to treat Mexicans completely differently. There are no restrictions at all placed on Mexican migration, but Mexicans are constructed as permanently deportable aliens. So what is developed in a sort of a collaboration between Congress and the business classes of the West and Southwest is this revolving door, this system of recruitment of temporary Mexican labor and their deportation when their labor is no longer needed.
So this ends, and then we get to this situation where we have this phenomenon of so-called illegal immigrants who come in and are the laborers. Explain how that came about.
So a lot of the explicitly racist, discriminatory legislation in the United States was dismantled after World War II. Part of this is dismantling the incredibly racist immigration system, which privileges European immigration and racially restricts non-Europeans from immigration and citizenship. And part of this is the Bracero program, which was widely understood to be an exploitative, discriminatory system that mistreated Mexican workers. All of this contributes to, number one, ending the Bracero program, which had been a demand of Mexican-American civil rights organizations. And you have the reform of U.S. immigration law with the passage of the Immigration and Nationality Act, the Hart-Celler Act, in 1965. Now, this new immigration law radically transformed the opening of U.S. immigration to all people. All racial restrictions were removed. And the national origins quota system, which was put into place in the 1920s, which privileged Northern Europeans, is also cast aside in favor of what's known under the INA, Hart-Celler Act, as a uniform quota. That is, under this guise of equality, all countries of the world, all nationalities are going to be treated equally. There's no special quotas. So every country has the right to an equal number of immigrants to the United States. So in 1965, suddenly both these things are ended, and this concept of illegality is now applied to those who cross outside of official channels. So the system continues, except that those who are crossing the border to do the seasonal labor suddenly have a new status, which is illegal. And from the mid-1960s through the end of the 20th century, this notion of illegality increasingly gains power as a rationale, as a legitimization for the permanent deportability of these Mexican workers.
Aviva, if you set aside the economic implications for a moment, a lot of people, including obviously the president, are concerned about security and the threat of terrorism or drug trafficking. Aren't some of these caps or some of these immigration policies necessary for safety, domestic security?
It's really after 9/11 that the idea of immigrants as a threat to national security starts to become prominent, with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, this constant throwing around of this terminology of terrorism and security, and the sort of vague notion that immigrants are a danger. So that 9/11, the creation of DHS, the creation of ICE in 2003, that's just one step in what has really been a long and ongoing process. In many ways, it increased after 2003 under the Bush administration and also under the Obama administration. So yes, we see it being taken to new heights now and expanding in certain directions where we didn't see it before. But I don't really think that what Trump is doing is anything fundamentally new. He's building on an infrastructure that was built well before his administration, that Democrats as well as Republicans have contributed to constructing, and that really goes back to the criminalization and exclusion of people of color that has been part of our history since the very first.
Thank you, Aviva. This has been fascinating. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We just learned about the laws and customs that laid the groundwork for widespread arrests and deportation of immigrants. Under the Trump administration, ICE's immigration enforcement machine has revved up. Part of this enforcement has meant targeting migrants with no criminal history. In the first half of the last fiscal year, most of those arrested by ICE had no criminal convictions. Meet Enrique Balcazar, an advocate for Migrant Justice, an organization in Vermont that organizes dairy workers.
My name is Enrique Balcazar. I am part of the migrants community here in Vermont. I've been living in Vermont for the last 7 years, and I'm a leader and spokesperson of my organization in my community, the dairy workers here in Vermont.
Last year, Balcazar was arrested by ICE with the help of an informant planted by the agency.
I was arrested on March 17, 2017, in the city of Burlington, Vermont, by four undercover agents, and I was detained along with Sully Palacios, who is also an organizer and a leader in the migrants community fighting for human rights. And yes, we do know that the informant was partly involved in our arrest.
The informant was a woman who lived in the community and befriended many locals, including Balcazar.
She's a part of the migrants community here in Vermont. The migrants community is, in general, very small in the state of Vermont. So it was easy for them to recruit her, for her to be present at different events. ICE always uses these types of tactics, and they do this through false promises. Many times they do it through intimidation or give false promises to the person they recruit.
Will Lambic is the communications director for Migrant Justice. The group is now suing the Trump administration and the local DMV over what they say is unlawful surveillance.
Over the past 2 years, 40 members of the immigrant community in Vermont who have been affiliated with Migrant Justice have been detained by federal immigration enforcement. About 20 of them have been active members, visibly and actively involved in the organization's human rights campaign work. We don't know for sure how many of these arrests are a result of the informant's activities or ICE's other surveillance activities, but through the course of this lawsuit, we intend to find out much more information that will reveal the scope and nature of ICE's attacks against our First Amendment protected activities.
Well, if you could just explain this lawsuit that has been filed here, are you arguing that the immigrants' rights were violated in this operation, and how so?
Everybody in this country, regardless of immigration status, has constitutional rights to freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. And when ICE came after Migrant Justice and its leadership, going out of their way to harass, surveil, detain, and deport members, they were violating those First Amendment rights. Migrant Justice filed a lawsuit in a federal district court against ICE, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Vermont DMV. In the lawsuit, we show that ICE engaged in a multi-year campaign to unlawfully target Migrant Justice and its leadership in violation of our First Amendment protected rights.
You mentioned the DMV. How do you believe that state motor vehicles workers were working with ICE to help them provide information that ICE could use in arresting immigrants?
In 2012 and 2013, Migrant Justice leaders led a campaign in this state to change the law allowing all residents to obtain a driver's license regardless of immigration status. However, right after the law's passage, some DMV employees went about undermining its implementation by discriminating against driver's license applicants and forwarding what they referred to as quote-unquote south of the border names to federal immigration authorities, including information that led to the arrest of Enrique Balcazar.
And it wasn't just the informant. What were the other ways that you believe ICE targeted Migrant Justice?
When they arrested people, they at times expressly forbid them from contacting Migrant Justice or their attorneys. They also maliciously spread disinformation about the organization, that Migrant Justice was in fact responsible for their arrests, that Migrant Justice had provided them information, which of course was untrue. And on top of that, the use of the informant shows this clear pattern of targeted retaliation against the organization to try to chill our First Amendment protected speech.
Why do you think ICE saw Migrant Justice as such a threat? What is the activity, what is the work that you guys are doing that apparently posed such a threat to ICE's mission and involvement in Vermont?
For nearly a decade, Migrant Justice has been organizing for human rights. It's an organization founded and led by immigrant dairy workers, folks who are working 60 to 80 hours a week in difficult and dangerous conditions for low pay, and who have come together to fight to advance their human rights to dignified work, to fair housing, to freedom of movement, to be free from discrimination. And at times, that human rights work had us take public stances against the abuses of immigrant enforcement in the state of Vermont and around the country. And quite frankly, ICE bristled at criticism against their activities, and they made it clear that they would be going after Quique, or Enrique Balcazar, because of his past public statements against ICE's enforcement activities.
Will Lambic is the communications director for Migrant Justice, and Enrique Balcazar is a migrant with the organization who was arrested by ICE with the help of an informant.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Amy Walter. While immigrants here illegally are being targeted by ICE, those with legal status are also under threat. In November of 2015, Stiven Lopez Bender was arrested in New Jersey after aiming a laser pointer at a news helicopter that was gathering footage of a fire near his house.
The crew alerted police. Newscopter 7 stayed over the scene to assist the police in tracking down the culprit. A short time later, police made an arrest.
Lopez Bender was in this country legally. He had a green card, but he was deported to Spain last month, leaving behind his wife and 4 kids, 2 of whom have medical conditions. Here's how he described what happened back in 2015.
I was with my son in my hand. I have like laser point to play with my son. And in the front of my house, it was there like 4 helicopters with point one of them. and I get in trouble because it's illegal, like, point the helicopter with a laser point. But I don't know the circumstance about this. So exactly this day, I get arrested for, by SBI. And after like a couple of months, I get 3-year probation. When I finish the probation, immigration going to take me, and they say that's illegal for them too. So I paid twice for the federal court and the immigration. I have 4 months in immigration jail, and I get deported from them when I leave 4 kids there in the United States.
Tell me, you are a green card holder. You were a legal permanent resident. How long had you been in the United States?
7 years. 7 years legal in the United States.
What were you doing in the United States for work?
I'm driving for Lyft and Uber. And I was working in JFK, Macy's, maintenance, housekeeping. I have several jobs over there.
And describe this pointer, this laser pointer. Was it a toy for your son? Was it something else entirely?
No, that's only to play with my son.
So this was a legal item. It was just the way you had pointed it at the helicopter that became a crime.
Yes.
How old was your son at the time?
1 year, 2 months. He's half 4 years now.
So he was enjoying this. You're pointing the laser at the helicopter. You don't think it's interfering with the helicopter's flight. You're just amusing your baby.
Exactly, because when I do this, my son was just laughing. There was 4 helicopters. So if I want to like do like something dangerous, I do it to the 4 helicopters, not only one. You know what I'm saying?
Lopez Bender pleaded guilty, but says he was only sentenced to 3 years of probation, and that was that. But then, in August of this year, he was selling his car. He posted his phone number for anyone interested, and he got a call. The person on the other line sounded like a potential buyer.
They told me, "Hi, how are you? What are you doing today?" I say, "I'm fine." So the guy asked me, "How much you sell your car?" I say, "I sell the car for $5,000. So he told me, "Oh, I want to see the car." I say, "Okay, I want to give you the address to you see the car." So in 3 minutes, it's come like 3 cars, 14 agents.
Well, what was
immigration
the,
take me.
So they tell you you're under arrest and that's it. They just take you away, a whole team of officers?
Yeah, he. When I get arrested, I go to the ICE office. He told me, "You got to sign your deportation right now. So if you don't sign, you got to be in trouble." So when he told me that, I said, "I can't sign the deportation because I have 4 kids. 2 of my kids have condition. So I can't like sign my deportation. Do whatever you have to do, but I don't going to sign." He say, "If you don't sign, I got to hit you in your face." I say, "Do whatever you want, but I don't going to sign because I have family here. I have my son, my wife, and I don't want to leave her alone, you know?"
And then they said, "If you're not going to sign, you get locked up." And then you ended up spending 4 months in jail.
Yeah.
And then you lost your case and you were deported.
Yes.
According to ICE, permanent resident aliens can be removed from the country for committing certain crimes involving moral turpitude. Today, Lopez Bender is living in the UK, and after months of separation from his family, they decided to leave the United States to join him in London. In fact, I talked with him while he was on his way to the airport to meet his wife.
I'm in the taxi right now with the guy. He's going to go with me to pick up my wife
and
my daughter and my son.
And your daughter and your son.
Yes.
And they're moving, they're all going to move to the UK.
Yes. She come with everything, the full luggage and everything, because we don't have nothing else there. That's the only we can do because she sold the car, everything for buy the ticket fly because we don't have nothing. We lost everything.
Are you optimistic? Are you hopeful about your new life?
Honestly, I'm really sad here because I really miss my family, you know? It's hard, like, to start over, you know what I'm saying, when we have everything, car, house, TV, couch, everything. But now we don't have nothing. We have to start over, you know what I'm saying?
2 of Stiven Lopez Bender's kids remain in the U.S. They have a different mom, and he told me he's not sure when or if he'll be able to see them again. He also told me about the difficult time he had in immigration detention here in the States. He lost more than 30 pounds and tried to commit suicide twice. And he still worries about the other immigrants held in the detention center, where he said conditions were desperate. He isn't hopeful about returning to the U.S., but for now, he'll start his new life in London with his wife and 2 kids.
The immigration system for years has failed.
That's Michael Cutler, a retired agent with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, or INS, which after 9/11 was broken up into different entities operating under the Department of Homeland Security. Cutler began his career back in 1971, and he's worked with many different parts of the immigration system.
Well, I began my career with the old INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. I was detailed as an adjudications officer. I became what was then called a criminal investigator / special agent, senior special agent, and assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, the FBI, DEA, ATF, Israel, Canada, Great Britain, and Japan, an expert witness in the House and Senate. I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission.
Cutler has long been calling for a complete overhaul of the immigration system. He wants secure borders and no leniency for anyone who comes illegally or overstays their visas. He says ICE needs more resources to do its job, and he believes all sides are responsible for the broken immigration system.
I call it failure by design. I blame both political parties. The immigration laws are designed to keep out criminals and aliens who would take the jobs of Americans. So in those broad categories, this is about counterterrorism, about going after organized crime and so forth. It's about keeping America and Americans safe. Now, the problem is that far too many people and far too many industries and other areas have come to see immigration as a way of profit. And so what it has turned into is a delivery system. The immigration system has, for decades, delivered a virtually unlimited supply of cheap, exploitable labor. Not just the illegal aliens who do the manual, physical, backbreaking work, but also even with the visa program to bring in high-tech workers that who displace American workers. It also brings in an unlimited supply of foreign students. It brings in foreign tourists. And finally, a virtually unlimited supply of clients for immigration law firms. So these are all failures by design, not because America can't get the job done, but America lacks the will to get the job done because far too many people are feeding at a very lucrative trough.
You were critical that after 9/11, there was this creation of the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Yes.
In order to address the problems that you just laid out. But you were critical of the creation of those agencies.
Yes.
What were your concerns at the time, and how was your opinion shifted?
Well, it hasn't. I think the Trump administration is trying to right some of the wrongs. But if you look at the way that DHS was created, I testified at a hearing, this was in 2005, about the dual missions of immigration. Incredibly, what the Bush administration did was to cut immigration into multiple components that exacerbated the entire program and created more problems. In fact, the creation of DHS de-emphasized immigration law enforcement at a time when it should have been emphasized.
But the direction has changed under President Trump, you believe, for the better?
Well, he's trying his best, but his hands are tied in terms of resources. You know, we have about 6,000 ICE agents. Now, let's remember the C in ICE stands for Customs, which has nothing to do with immigration. So you have 6,000 ICE agents for the whole country, half of whom aren't even doing immigration work. We're down to 3,000 ICE agents. So with those numbers, certainly immigration law enforcement isn't really providing the security or effective enforcement measures that deter illegal activities that it needs to have.
Can you make the case that those who are here undocumented, who are here illegally, as you said, are a threat to Americans, are a public safety threat in general?
Oh, absolutely. We admit 1 million lawful immigrants every year. They abide by the laws. They do what they're supposed to do. And think how offensive it is to them if they come to the United States legally at great expense and over a period of time, and now we're going to legalize people or permit people to remain illegally who shouldn't be here in the first place. People come to the United States illegally for a bunch of reasons. And some of the people who are illegally present were previously deported. They might be coming simply to work, which creates its own problems because they're taking jobs that Americans or lawful immigrants should be taking. But on the other hand, and I have found this as an agent because I made thousands of arrests, I'm proud to tell you, as an agent, many of them are fugitives from justice in other countries. I've arrested people from Israel and England and elsewhere who were wanted for murder in their home countries. They fled to the United States to escape the long arm of the law. And most of the drug trafficking organizations engage in human trafficking as well. We know that women are trafficked and children are trafficked for sex purposes. So understand that we've created a whole undercurrent of illegal activity. In fact, when people enter the United States without inspection, they are evading a vetting process to make certain that the aliens who are under those categories of exclusion don't gain access to our country.
Do you reject the belief that a lot of Americans have that the vast majority even of immigrants who are coming in illegally or not are coming simply to make a better life? And that the reason why they're coming here without documentation or illegally or as illicit aliens is because it's just a lot harder to get here through the front door like it used to be several decades ago and through most of American history. So they're coming in crossing the Rio Grande, or they're overstaying their visas, but their motivations are not necessarily nefarious. They're really just looking to, you know, put food on the table for their kids. I mean, this is a belief that many Americans have who support, you know, a pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants.
You know, America is a country of limited resources also. So we're looking at a whole bunch of issues, but let's start with public safety. If someone refuses to properly identify themselves, the likelihood is there is something in their background that they don't want you to know about. Let me ask you a question.
Isn't it just because they can't get actual authorization to live here legally? I mean, they can't get permanent residency. They can't get a driver's license because they don't have, you know, the proper paperwork, and they overstayed their visa. Wouldn't that be why they're
some
avoiding
of them? But how many people have suffered identity theft because we have a huge population of illegal aliens that are eager to purchase someone else's good name? Look, we have a lawful system. We're spending $14 billion a year on Customs and Border Protection. We employ over 60,000 people at CBP, Customs and Border Protection. So my question to you is this. If you believe that it's reasonable that we throw open the doors for people who simply want a better life, would you be willing to order the end of Customs and Border Protection and end inspecting passengers who arrive at ports of entry so that anybody who wants to come here can hop on a plane, come to America, and be treated no differently at Kennedy Airport than a passenger arriving from Alabama, let's say?
Let me drill into that question for a second. Can you tell me your understanding of what ICE's responsibilities are currently, and if under the Trump administration, if you have any criticism of the way it is currently operating? There are some ICE officers who say the handcuffs are off and now they can actually fulfill their mission. Is that happening?
Well, the handcuffs still aren't off because, again, we have limited numbers of agents, and again, we have limitations. And so when you have both political parties who've engaged in this debate saying as a foregone conclusion, we can't deport all who are here illegally, so let's legalize them. You know, we don't do that with any other area of law enforcement. This encourages more illegal immigration. The Reagan amnesty encouraged more illegal immigration. And once you convince people that if they could enter the United States and sooner or later they're going to get whatever it was that brought them here in violation of law, then you're encouraging chaos and anarchy within a system that's designed to protect us.
Michael Cutler is a retired agent with the Immigration and Naturalization Service. We end the hour with a look at the politics behind ICE and how it polls with the American public. If you ask President Trump, ICE agents are American heroes, working tirelessly to keep us safe.
Every day, border agents are keeping drugs, crime, and gangs from entering our country.
On the left, some Democrats have called for abolishing the agency altogether.
We should abolish ICE. We should create something better, something different.
I believe you should get rid of it, start over, reimagine it.
We've got to critically reexamine ICE and its role and the way that it is being administered and the work it is doing. And we need to probably think about starting from scratch.
But this idea does not poll well with American voters.
Calls for abolishing ICE look like a political loser.
That's Cameron Easley, editor for Washington at Morning Consult, a polling firm.
Most voters, 54%, said they want to keep ICE versus a quarter who say it should be gotten rid of. Republicans, not surprisingly, overwhelmingly favoring keeping ICE. That was about 4 in 5 Republican voters, and also a majority of independents as well.
And even among Democrats, support for this idea is mixed.
43% plurality supported getting rid of it, but it still split the base, with 34% also opposing the idea.
Then what do Americans support when it comes to immigration reform? That's complicated.
immigration polling in general is a little bit contradictory. If you look at the top line support for something like securing deportation protection for Dreamers, you know, the people who were brought illegally into the country when they were children, often with their parents, we find, you know, 3/4 of the general public, including a strong majority, nearly roughly 2/3 of Republicans, supporting those protections. But when you get down to it, and you ask these voters to place their priorities for what they want to see Congress do, we see those numbers fall in half. It's not that Republican voters don't want to take care of the Dreamers or the larger undocumented community. It's just that it's not a big priority for them. And there's a segment of the base that is very, very dead set on taking extreme measures, not letting anyone into the country. And they seem to be really the voters that the leaders end up listening to. You know, you go back to 2013, a Gang of Eight bipartisan immigration bill would have provided border security, would have allowed a path to citizenship for the undocumented community in the country, passed the Senate with 68 votes. But Speaker Boehner at the time refused to put it on the floor, and that was because he was getting a lot of pressure from that far-right flank.
Right. So immigration is not necessarily a priority for voters, at least not in top one or two priority. But for a certain segment of the each party's base, it is a top priority.
It is. And I think the problem for the Democrats there is, I think, whereas Republicans are a little bit more united on what to do with immigration in a lot of respects, you see that division even among Democratic voters when it comes to that issue. It could be a tricky issue for the party to navigate, especially as we move into the 2020 primary.
So what is Congress likely to do on immigration next year? For more on that, we turn to Dara Lind, senior reporter on immigration for Vox.
It's going to be a proposal to legalize Dreamers, in some capacity, young unauthorized immigrants who came to the U.S. as children, and probably to offer some kind of legal status to temporary protected status holders as well, who are currently legal, but who the Trump administration has been kind of trying to sunset the legal status that they've held for, in many cases, over a decade. That said, the Senate's not going to pass that bill.
Right.
What you are actually going to see in terms of things that could get across the president's desk are going to be fights every time there's a new funding bill from a wing of the Democratic Party that is going to look to decrease the current funding levels and certainly to be to scrutinize very heavily, specifically immigration detention, which ICE is currently holding at much greater capacity even than they're currently funded for, and that a lot of Democrats have had as a target for some years as an easy way to reduce the capacity that ICE has to arrest and detain unauthorized immigrants.
Are they going to have to make some sort of trade-off in any sort of final deal related to immigration if they want to cut back on the amount of money that they appropriate ICE for detention? What are they going to give Trump and the Republicans?
So this is much less clear on both sides, right? In the past, immigration deals have been made by, you know, offering some form, broader immigration reform has taken the form of some form of legalization paired with throwing a lot of money at enforcement, often at border security, but sometimes in interior enforcement as well. Not only have Republicans kind of gotten antsier about the idea of any form of legalization, but that is no longer a politically costless move for Democrats anymore. You know, when Chuck Schumer was saying a couple of weeks ago that he was okay giving $1.6 billion on border security, even if it didn't take the form of a wall, a lot of progressive Democrats said, no, the starting position here needs to be zero. We don't need to throw more money at this. So it's going to be, there is definitely a question about how much leeway Schumer and specifically Nancy Pelosi, who, you know, has the majority in her chamber, will have to kind of give things up on, you know, throwing money in some places in order to get policy or funding things that Democrats want on the other side. Really, what's going to be happening next year is the culmination of a trend that's happened for the last few years, in that Democrats are now just way to the left on enforcement from where they were the last time they had power in Congress. Certainly, you know, from where they were when it Barack Obama held the presidency and they actually had a certain amount of responsibility for the immigration enforcement apparatus. The Democratic Party over the last few years has stopped kind of making apologies for interior enforcement and has started really leaning into the idea that unauthorized immigrants who are in the United States for the most part should not be getting deported or shouldn't have to live with the risk of deportation.
And what about among Republicans? Is there a consensus among Republicans? In the past, DACA, which allows undocumented children to stay in the country, has been a big bargaining chip. Is that still the case?
Many Republicans have been willing to vote for an immigration reform package. There are some who are ideologically opposed to it, but there are plenty who are willing to go along with it if there's political cover for them. What they appear to have learned in the last 2 years, specifically in early 2018, when there was a push to kind of legalize DACA recipients, that it was that they couldn't trust the White House to provide that political cover. So the big question for them right now is, are they willing to get out in front of a deal, even if they can't be confident that President Trump will be saying all the way that it's important to him and that he wants to get it passed?
Dara Lind is senior reporter on immigration for Vox. Who gets to come to the United States and who gets to stay? These are questions the country has been grappling with from the beginning, and the answers have only gotten more complicated. Some of the new questions we're left with today: should an immigrant who overstayed his visa be locked up in a county jail for a year at a cost to American taxpayers so far of $40,000? Should a legal permanent resident on probation for a nonviolent crime be split from his family, possibly forever? Should all immigrants who violate our immigration laws be removed, even if it means using tactics like infiltrating nonprofits? Because in this era, national security is paramount to any other arguments. People are crossing borders and migrating around the earth at a pace unprecedented in human history. They're looking for safety and economic security. They're fleeing destruction from climate change. And so immigration will continue to be the story of our time. But until our legislators and Congress agree on ways of absorbing people into the United States by balancing humanity and security, ICE, under the direction of whoever is in the Oval Office, has the power to decide who gets to stay here and who has to go. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz. Amy Walter is back next week. See you soon. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.